Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, are you boring and unambitious? Spirits in the television or just strange weather conditions? Chinese teletext? Surely not. Sponsor a species, a new fundraiser for conservation work? A look at the life of Niels Bohr, little-known pioneer of quantum mechanics, the foundation of modern electronics. 20-bit quality from 16, a report from the Audio Engineering Society, valves to the rescue. Safety at rock concerts, essential new revisions, or are they being killjoys? How I long for the old airwaves. Do Radio 4 listeners really want FM, or are they just long-wave junkies? It's all on Sparks this week, along with the answers to our recent competition and your letters. Radio fax on 3910 6205 and 12255. Here's a letter from Andrew Preece, who's in Inverness. I've been in Glasgow for the last few months, he starts, and your 6205 signal is strong there as well as here on my Ferguson 3T28 radio cassette thing, with an old piece of mains flex about 7 foot long connected to the aerial with a crocodile clip. Sounds like my kind of setup. On this in Inverness, I've heard a weak 12255 signal. Weekend Music Radio is on 6240, as with a signal as strong as yours. They were on 6296 and are also on 7445, which is weak here, and on 1611 also. Radio Dublin has a good signal on 6910 with much better modulation than a few years ago. Not sure I agree with that particular comment about the modulation. Maybe they've improved it. Also heard today were Radio Delta, Ozone International and BRI. I haven't heard any FM or medium wave pirates in Glasgow recently. About 14 months ago there were quite a few, but they've all disappeared. Now he also asks if there's anyone in Ireland who'd be prepared to get him a copy of an LP called Nevermind the Zoggabongs, Here's Zig and Zag by Zig and Zag, which apparently Dave Fanning's been playing on his show on 2FM. If anybody would be prepared to do that for Andrew Preece, then contact us via the usual address. Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. As ever, if you'd like to write to us, please enclose 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1 if you'd like a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. However, if you just want a reply on the radio and general hello, you don't have to send anything, and I guarantee to read a bit of your letter out on air. Lots more letters in the programme, but first, this.
Minimally audible noise shaping. This is by the Audio Research Group from the University of Waterloo, Ontario in Canada, and published in the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society. Normal quantization or requantization noise is white, but the ear's sensitivity to low-level broadband noise is not uniform with frequency. By adopting a suitable weighting curve to represent low-level noise audibility, one can design dithered requantizing noise shapers for analog-to-digital and D-to-A systems to approximate the inverse of the audibility curve of the human ear and hence achieve the least audible noise penalty. The authors in this paper use a modified E weighting curve, which allows a reduction in noise level of theoretically 20 dB in the requantizing noise after audio has been converted from analog to digital and then back to analog again. Such noise shaping will soon be advantageous in order to preserve on the 16-bit compact disc the lower noise floor of an original 18 or 20-bit master recording. The use of a noise shaping feedback loop around a quantizer dates from at least the early 1960s. In fact, Philips used a combination of simple first-order noise shaping and four times interpolation in their first line of compact disc players in the early 1980s in order to eke 16-bit noise from a 14-bit digital to analog converter. In this paper, we explore some of the possibilities for the design of psychoacoustically optimized noise shapers whose noise spectrum is tailored so as to be least audible. If oversampling is allowed, one can easily make drastic reductions in the perceived baseband requantizing noise. In this paper, we address the more difficult question of substantially reducing the apparent noise contributed by a requantization without raising the sampling rate. These questions are relevant for a number of reasons. First, professional master recordings will soon be captured using 18 or even 20-bit analog-to-digital converters. Assuming that these new conversion systems achieve close to their theoretical noise floors, the need will soon arise to be able to perform word length reductions to the 16-bit CD format without an apparent 12 or 24 dB noise increase in the process. To a lesser extent, the same situation arises when any digital manipulations are performed on already quantized signals, for it is necessary to truncate the longer internal word lengths to the desired lower output word length. Second, any such requantization operation must be appropriately dithered in order to avoid quantization distortion and noise modulation. The paper then goes through the theory of all of this, and gives practical noise shaper results for system based on the CD sampling rate of 44.1 kHz, and ends with these conclusions. We have shown that noise shapers of orders less than 10 can achieve weighted noise power reductions of about 2 bits, or 12 dB, with ease, and over 3 bits, or 18 dB, with still acceptable total unweighted noise penalties. More work is desirable with the aim of standardizing the most audibly meaningful weighting curve for low-level broadband noise. Nevertheless, a very significant and worthwhile perceived noise reduction is already possible with the designs covered in this paper. One immediately apparent benefit of these schemes is the ability to hear a considerable apparent increase in low-level signal resolution as a consequence of the reduced aural masking by the quantization noise as a result of its redistribution to regions of the spectrum where it is less audible. In particular, the removal of noise from the region of greatest sensitivity, around 3 kHz, is mainly responsible for this effect. The ability to reduce word lengths by 2 to 3 bits, without apparent noise penalty, can be of benefit to the audio industry, as professional digital recordings of 18 or more bits resolution begin to find their way onto the 16-bit CD medium. Another side benefit of noise-shaped rounding schemes is the increased smoothing of digital-to-analog converter non-linearities, contributed by the larger excursions which the increased total noise power provides. Of course, such converter non-linearities will prevent the achievement of the designed shaped noise spectrum by filling in the dips, and will introduce some measure of noise modulation too. So the requirement for accurate digital-to-analog converters remains. That paper describing techniques which will allow the 16-bit CD standard that we're stuck with now to provide higher definition of 18 or possibly 20 bits by Stanley Lipschitz, John Van Der Kooi and Robert Wanamaker from the University of Waterloo, Ontario, Canada in the AES Journal.
Quite amazing. That's the most thinking you'll have to do for this programme anyway. So, more straightforward from here on. A letter from Bruno Alcaraz. J'écoute les ondes courtes, le monde au bout des doigts. Reception radio à longue distance. He listens on a Sony ICF SW7600 telescopique aerial. He writes, I enjoyed your music and I try to hear you every night. Well, I hope he enjoyed it more than me murdering his friends. French, however, he lives in Belfort in France. Thanks to Bruno Alcaraz for that letter. Do you have any 813 valves in your junk box? We've now used up our own stocks, so if you have any 813s you don't want and you'd like to see them going to a good use, please wrap them up very well and send them to us. We will immediately refund your postage costs, put them to good use, and be very appreciative, as I'm sure you can imagine. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts, our weekly programme of media, scientific and technical news.
Those of us who listen to Radio Netherlands would have been shocked by the details given in the Media Network programme, which would mean the end of coverage of Europe on shortwave.
What lies behind the truth? Radio Netherlands investigates.
In this case, the truth about Radio Netherlands. We're currently preparing to make some major changes to our English language output, as from the summer schedule. That starts on Sunday, March the 29th. Mind you, hardly a day goes by without letters or faxes coming in to our office asking about our English service to Europe.
Our shortwave transmitters are simply too close to the UK and Ireland to give adequate service in the evenings.
And our Flavo shortwave transmitter site can't broadcast at frequencies lower than the 49-meter band. A possible medium-wave service has been floated several times, but at present this can't be realised because of usage by the Dutch domestic radio organisations.
We're still hopeful that things might change, but not for the summer period of 1992.
Rather than struggle on offering a second-rate coverage, we've decided to suspend our European service in English at 11:30 and also the release at 14:30 UTC. We're now part of a project to set something up to replace it.
Jonathan Marks there describing how Radio Netherlands plans to abandon covering Europe on shortwave, to the dismay of many, I'm sure.
In The Observer, sponsor a species plan lets you name your pleasure or poison. How would you like to name an orchid, a butterfly, or even a rat after your loved or unloved one? British scientists are considering a plan to auction off the names of newly discovered species to raise money for conservation work. One of nature's less attractive creatures, such as a flea, might go just for a few £100. Something more glamorous, perhaps an elegant new bird, could fetch millions. Scientists backing the proposal point out that seven Costa Rican wasps have already raised $300,000 to help save their habitat. Eruga Gutfruundi, the most important of the seven wasps, was named after John H. Gutfrund, a New York debt trader at Salomon Brothers, who handled a loan for the Guanacaste National Park and its conservation unit. Dr. Ian Gold, an entomologist at London's Natural History Museum, explained the extraordinary story. Salomon were due a $300,000 fee on a debt arrangement for Costa Rica. We named seven wasps after their directors, and they were so pleased they waived their fee, he explained. The wasps ended up with a particularly appropriate sponsor. The Eruga Gutfrundi's favourite diet is the eggs of another insect, called the money spider. Dr. Gold, who normally discovers and names over 100 new wasps every year, backs the sponsor a species proposal. Having seen what seven wasps can raise, he is convinced there is a great potential for winning more financial support for conservation. At a going rate of more than £32,000 a wasp, the annual income from wasp nomenclature alone could top £4 million. Natural History Museum keeper Dr. Steve Blackmore points out that British scientists identify and name thousands of new species every year. There must be thousands, maybe tens of thousands of insects and plants which we have to name, he explained. Under the sponsor a species proposal, individuals or companies would bid for the right to name newly identified species. There has, however, been some opposition to the idea from taxonomists, the scientific profession who classify organisms. Dr. Gould explained, taxonomists are an extremely conservative bunch of people. Well, if I had to sit there and catalogue insects all day, perhaps so would I be. That's a report from The Observer. Far be it from me to name drop, but we'll thank Jonathan Marks for his card saying good luck with Radio Facts. He sent us a very posh Radio Netherlands card with a picture of Rembrandt on the front. Here's a letter from Alex Radlivik from Burton-on-Trent in Staffordshire. He describes 3910 as the best in my area, the Northern Midlands. I would like to congratulate everyone for very good features and an excellent programme structure on Radio Fax. I would like to tell all the staff to keep up the good work and to wish all of them a slightly late Merry Christmas and best wishes for 1992. Well, it's even more late now. Thanks, Alex Radulovic from Burton-on-Trent.
How I long for the old airwaves. In The Independent, FM is the darling band of the broadcasters, yet Maggie Brown only gets crackles when she tries to tune in to Radio 4. I start the day with Radio 4 and the Today programme. The radio I use is ancient, bulky and permanently tuned to 1500 metres long wave. The knob has fallen off, so I couldn't change channels even if I wanted to. This isn't so inconvenient. Most people hate fiddling and stick with the station they know. My old warhorse provides excellent reception. When I go downstairs, however, I use a small modern Sony portable with FM and medium wave frequencies. On this set, I aim to be promiscuous, sampling radios 1 and 3 and the new London stations. But while today booms out happily upstairs, the much newer radio downstairs cannot cope. It is interrupted by attacks of crackles so unpleasant that my 2-year-old beats me in the rush to turn it off. The reception is so sensitive, so wayward, that sometimes I resort to placing the set outside on the windowsill, extending the aerial, even standing it on its end. I mentioned this irritating problem about FM reception to Johnny Beerling, controller of Radio 1. He said cheerfully that a lot of people didn't know how to tune their radios properly. He sent a very helpful BBC official, Henry Price, head of engineering information, to my house to sort me out. He told me I was in good company. Mr. Price had recently been to the house of Marmaduke Hussey, chairman of the BBC, to explain to his wife why her radio suffered interference. Johnny Beerling himself had had him round. Reception in his Docklands home is affected by FM signals bouncing around tall buildings. I started asking acquaintances if they had good FM radio reception. They didn't. Mr. Price knew exactly what was wrong. My 4 household radios were tuned properly, but my home in Dulwich is in a radio black spot some 4 miles wide. It is too close to the Beulah Hill transmitter on the Crystal Palace Ridge in South London. This mast broadcasts the FM signals for London's local radio services to an area roughly encompassed by the M25. This means that they are far stronger than the BBC national radio FM signals for the South East, which come from the more distant main transmitter at Rootham in Kent. The Beulah Hill signals crowd out radios 1, 3 and 4, hence the persistent interference. Still, FM, with its very high-frequency signal, is the darling of the airwaves because it allows sound to be broadcast in stereo. This makes it essential for transmitting top-class music. But Mr. Price says that FM is more delicate, much more sensitive than the long-wave signals. It was fine for people on top of hills, but not so good for those in the valleys. It doesn't like copper pipes, which make the signals misbehave. That is one reason why reception in bathrooms is notoriously bad. It also has a distressing tendency to wander, and if a bus parks outside the house or the central heating comes on, FM reception could be affected. Mr. Price says that the BBC's engineers have tested scores of modern radio sets to see if they could cope with the sensitive demands of FM. They found that 3/4 were below the reception standards assumed by planners of frequency allocations. In an attempt to relieve the problem, the BBC has been developing its own radio sets, complete with something called Radio Data Signalling, or RDS. This automatically retunes the set to the best FM transmission available. Recently, though, the BBC project has hit snags and delays. Meanwhile, car radios equipped with RDS tend to be confined to the top end of the market. Yet the system is essential for listeners on long journeys if they are to be handed over smoothly from one FM transmitter to another. The fact is that Radio 4 on long wave is easier to find, easier to use, and far more robust. It is the only English language service on that waveband. Well, we all know that there's Atlantic 252 sitting there, but anyway, to continue with Maggie Brown's article, it goes almost anywhere, as its lengthy waves bounce off the ionosphere and are unaffected by hills, valleys, or woods. It doesn't like heavily reinforced steelwork or television and computer interference, but other than that, it is very reliable reception, said Mr. Price, broadcast from one mast in Droitwich. This single transmitter provides 100% coverage for the nation. Another mistake there, because there's also a transmitter at Burghead and Westerglen in Scotland. All of this has huge implications. The government has ordered single-frequency broadcasting, one channel per frequency, to allow commercial radio to expand. This means that some popular services will soon only be available on the elusive FM. Some already are. Radio 2 lost its medium wave frequency in August 1990 in order to accommodate Radio 5 and is now available only on FM. On the 28th of February, Radio 3 will be confined to FM only, stripped of its medium wave frequency to make space for a second commercial national channel. But what about those of us who can't receive FM properly? There are hundreds of black spots, like mine in Dulwich, where FM reception is poor. Last summer, the BBC encouraged people to tune in to Radio 4 on FM wherever possible because it was servicing the Droitwich mast. It got 2,500 calls a week from Radio 4 devotees worried about losing the long-wave service. The BBC is examining its output closely in its efforts to persuade the government and public to continue funding it from the licence fee. As part of the Charter Review, which is making recommendations for the future, it has suggested using Radio 4 Longwave for a rolling news service with the bulk of Radio 4's output on FM. David Hatch, Managing Director of BBC Radio, cautions that Radio 4 is the very heartland of the corporation's output and should not be mucked around. Jocelyn Hay, chairwoman of the Voice of the Viewer and Listener, a pressure group founded in 1983 to preserve Radio 4, says it is unique. It must be on longwave and FM. There are innumerable problems with FM reception. The BBC must not be allowed to do this. But the BBC is caught in a cleft stick because of government policy. We have to look at ways of differentiating the services to keep the frequencies, says Henry Price, my helpful engineer. Otherwise, the government might come along and ask why we are duplicating things and take more frequencies away. Radio 4, he says, is going to be the most difficult decision. This is because Radio 1 listeners are younger and more adept at tuning their sets. Radio 3 listeners, a much smaller audience, appreciate the FM sound quality. But, Mr. Price says, Radio 4 audiences are not interested in the technology. They use whichever is best. And there is a high degree of satisfaction with longwave. Up to half the audience listens on longwave. They are bound to say, we are perfectly happy. Why do I need to change? That piece was by Maggie Brown, published in The Independent. And of course, everyone's forgotten the enormous fuss when the frequency changes occurred about 15 years ago and Radio 4 was moved from medium wave to long wave. And there then ensued the most enormous outcry about how completely unusable long wave was for speech programming like Radio 4 and how it was far more suitable for Radio 2.
Yes, even I remember that, and I must have been about 10 at the time. Yeah. Michael Ravnier writes from Hanog, Saint-Martin in France. The signal quality in northern France is good and clear. I am 28 years old, working in Paris in computing service of the French train company. At the weekends I come back in Hanog, Saint-Martin. I'm not married, so I have free time enough for listening to shortwave very regularly. What is it that married people are so busy doing that stops them listening to shortwave, I ask? Anyway, he continues, I listen with a communications receiver Drake R4245 with an outdoor aerial dipole with a length of 30 metres, placed around 10 metres above the ground and beamed east-west. Thanks very much for that letter, Michael Ravenier. Fresh Radio Facts programmes start on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays. And you can hear us on 3910, 6205 and 12255. In The Observer, Golden Niels and Giddy Atoms. David Pringle looks at a new review of his life. In print by Adam Pay, Niels Bohr's Times in Physics, Philosophy and Polity. Niels Bohr was a man of disarming honesty, a pioneer of quantum mechanics. He confessed, if anyone says he can think about quantum mechanics without getting giddy, that only shows he has not understood the first thing about it. Abraham Pay, who frequently thinks about quantum problems, appears to have been clear-headed when writing this account of Niels Bohr's life. He is one of the last physicians alive to have worked with both Bohr and Einstein, whose clash of minds he witnessed. Bohr's contribution to physics has been ranked with that of Newton, yet today he is virtually unknown beyond the borders of science and his native Denmark. Born in 1885, Bohr grew up in an academic family. His father was nominated for a Nobel Prize after discovering the effect of carbon dioxide on hemoglobin. I'm silver, but Niels is gold, said Christian Bohr presciently. While preparing for his final school exams, Niels disputed points in the physics textbook. Asked what he would do if they arose in the exam, Niels replied, "Well, of course, explain that this is all bosh, and the phenomena need to be interpreted quite differently." As a postgraduate, his first encounter with the discoverer of the electron, J.J. Thompson, opened with the words, "This is wrong." A chance meeting with Ernest Rutherford in 1911 marked a turning point. Bohr was introduced to Rutherford's newly discovered nucleus. Within 2 years, Bohr had created a quantized model of the atom. It became known as the Bohr-Rutherford model. The old guard was sceptical, even enraged, by the quantum interpretation, and so Bohr set off on an often lonely journey towards the 1923 Nobel Prize. The revolution which swept classic physics aside and supplanted it with Bohr's quantum theory and the quantum mechanics of Schrödinger and Heisenberg makes a complex story which Pei unravels with mastery. The pioneers of the new frontier and the intensity and excitement of their explorations are vividly described. Even the emergence of spin quantum numbers is rendered with immediacy. As Bohr journeyed across Europe by train, he was greeted at a series of stations by leading physicists, all eager to discuss the outrageous spin postulate of two young Dutchmen. Amid slamming train doors, Pauli Stern, Ehrenfest, Einstein, Heisenberg, and Jordan each in turn asked, "What do you think of spin?" Another series of brief encounters took place during the return journey, with Bohr becoming more and more convinced that spin had arrived. Bohr's major contribution to quantum mechanics concerned its physical meaning, as expressed in the now orthodox Copenhagen interpretation. This new paradigm represents a radically altered view of the subatomic world. Observer and system are no longer independent. Systems possess no dynamic attributes of their own. This rejection of determinism led Bohr into lasting confrontation with Albert Einstein, the other natural great philosopher of his era. C.P. Snow once observed that no more profound intellectual debate has ever been conducted. Pei would concur, although he argues that it had less influence on Bohr's physics than on his psyche. Even after Einstein's death, he would still argue with him as if he were still alive. In Niels Bohr's times, time stops in 1963 when Bohr died, so Pays never directly answers his own question of why Bohr's significance has escaped the current generation. He fails to examine the status of the Copenhagen interpretation in the light of the recent work of many scientists. Pay believes that the logic of quantum mechanics reached its closure with the expression of the Copenhagen interpretation. The writer's closeness to Bohr and his family is both a strength and a weakness. Personal reticence leads to some peculiar omissions. For instance, we learn nothing of Bohr's relationship with his son, Argy, who worked closely with his father and won a Nobel Prize himself in 1975. The physicist Bohr is well defined. The man remains elusive. Essential reading for serious physicists, Niels Bohr's Times, is also accessible to the general reader. There are few equations, and the 565 pages are divided into short sections with pithy headings. Terms which the uninitiated may stumble over are defined. The book is handsomely presented, and given the staggering prices of academic works, good value at £25. You can, of course, go and pester your local library and get them to order you a copy of that. Niels Bohr's Times by Abraham Pay.
In electronics and wireless world, there's a letter from somebody trying to track down a film or television programme from the mid-1950s. Sporadic E or Spirit World. I have recently come across a group of people who claim to have received images from beyond the grave on television sets. The phenomenon known as TV-EVP, Television Electronic Voice Phenomenon, is promoted by a group originating in Luxembourg, who claim to have a hotline to a spirit guide known as Technician. They appear to be surprised that many of the images seen are of famous German people, including National Socialists. One viewer is known to have been shocked that such evil people have gone to heaven. Another image received was of Hannah Buschbeck, a famous extrasensory perception personality who died aged 84. However, her image was when she was 30. Because she did not wish to project herself as an 84-year-old. It is claimed that the image has been identified with photographs of her taken when she was 30. The idea of intermittent long-distance TV reception of films and documentaries does not seem to have occurred to the group, and they doggedly persist in sending out videos, newsletters, and so on. One individual claims that there is a worldwide cover-up sponsored by governments and the churches who apparently don't want the populace to receive the proof that there is life after death and that contact can be made with the dead. The alleged motivation for this cover-up is not known to me. There is a story going around that in 1955 or 1956, a Mr. H. Reeves, who lived on the south coast on a hill, appeared on British television, possibly on the evening news magazine Highlight. He related how he received a spirit message on his television from Technician and a group called Timestream. He was later confused with Mr. Alec Reeves, the inventor of PCM, who was also interested in ESP. If any reader has a recollection of this broadcast about Mr. H. Reeves' activities, I would be grateful to have details, because as someone who knew Alec Reeves, I am asked about this. I would also be interested to hear from anyone who knows of a television play or film broadcast in the mid-1950s, snatches of which may have been received by Mr. H. Reeves by Sporadic E or Meteor Scatter, that contained a character called Technician and a group called Timestream. It could have been an early regional ITV play. Best of all, of course, is the possibility that Mr. H. Reeves is still alive. That letter from John de Rivaz in Porth Towan in Cornwall, and it's published in Electronics and Wireless World. So do get in touch if you know anything about these strange goings-on.
Quite an extraordinary story. In sound and communication engineering, details of the new code on the loudness of pop music. A draft copy of the new pop code fell onto the desk recently, with the sort of thud that suggested a reassuringly thorough set of guidelines. The title of the draft is A Guide to Health, Safety and Welfare at Pop Concerts and Other Similar Events. But everyone is adopting the old GLC's pop code, upon which the new draft is partly based. The code aims to set a nationwide standard and has been drafted by the Health and Safety Executive. The 166-page document contains recommendations covering both indoor and outdoor events. It applies to the club scene live act as much as to the likes of Pavarotti in the Park or Nebworth. The guidelines cover such diverse details as the ratio of toilets needed to audience numbers and briefing bands on how to assist in audience evacuation during an emergency. Sound and noise accounts for just 10 pages of the guidelines, but the proposals are probably the most far-reaching in the whole report. Mean levels of sound pressure over the period of a concert are recommended, as well as peak levels. Concerts should carry a health warning if sound is likely to exceed a certain level.
citing BS7443, which sets new levels for clarity in public address. The code says there should be a separate PA system run by the same person for emergency broadcasts, which can take precedence over the music PA. Safe cabling is addressed, with BS5839, the fire alarm standard, quoted as affecting permanent installations. The average level is measured as LAEQ, equivalent continuous sound pressure level, and is set at 104 dBA for the duration of a concert, no matter how long. This is higher than the GLC limit, which was set at 93 dBA for an 8-hour period. Promoters are asked to inform the audience, through programmes or publicity, that there is potential hearing damage when the LAEQ exceeds 96 dBA. Peak limits in the new guide are set at 140 dBA, which is the same limit set by the Noise at Work regulations. The code reminds promoters that, as employers, they must ensure event staff are protected and informed of the danger from continual exposure to noise. For those working at concerts, from musicians to bar staff, there are two action levels set at 85 and 90 dBA, which require varying levels of protection, such as earplugs for 90 dBA plus. When one considers that the background noise at many gigs is as much as 85 dB before the amps are turned on, it is seen as essential that anyone working in a noisy atmosphere should be protecting their ears. The famous image of the concert fan, air guitar in hand, trying to get his head as close to the magnets of a 15-inch subwoofer as possible, will become legally dated with the POP code. Members of the audience should not be allowed within 3 metres of a working loudspeaker. This proposal will affect the positioning of many loudspeakers, particularly in clubs, if they are set into the stage front or flown just above a dance floor. Barriers conforming to the latest surge pressure safety levels will have to be erected around speaker systems. The LAEQ measurements should be taken at these barriers and at the mixing desk to establish the correct levels before the concert or during rehearsals. Where speakers have to be driven at high levels to reach the back of an audience, the code recommends rigging supplementary speaker systems or delay towers. While the levels set inside an auditorium are slightly higher than those set by the GLC, levels outside the event have been made more comprehensive. The code looks at noise control outside concert venues and notes that performances on consecutive nights can give rise to, quote, considerable annoyance. Using the LA90 yardstick, which measures 15 minutes of background noise in a similar location and period to that proposed for the concert, events are split into 3 groups of 1 day, 2 to 12 days, and more than 12 days. The ENL, or event noise level, also measured over 15 minutes, at 1 metre from the facade of a concert, quietens from 25 dBA to 15 dBA and 5 dBA for the 3 categories. For concerts lasting up to 12 days, the code says ENL should not exceed the background noise level between the hours of 2300 and 0900 at any noise-sensitive location and should be inaudible, quote, from longer-running events. The new guidelines are partly based on results of tests conducted by Travers Morgan, the East Grinstead-based consultancy. Existing legislation and the Health and Safety Executive's own specialist research had been brought together in the code, according to Alan Bell, for the HSE. Travers Morgan covered 18 concerts from rock and house to MOR, with audiences between 1,000 and 80,000. Coincidentally, the average LAEQ of all the concerts at the barrier by the speakers was 104.7 dBA. though this was kept down by the MOR events. MOR being middle of the road music. TM's research showed that 60% of the concerts exceeded the LAEQ guidelines, while 22% broke the peak levels of 140 dB. Only one of the concerts was within the old GLC code, while the worst offender had an LAEQ of 113 dB over 160 minutes, with peaks of 146 dB. At these levels, beyond the pain threshold and louder than a jet at takeoff, individuals will certainly suffer hearing damage, according to Professor Evans of Keele University. The professor's recent research into 15 to 23-year-olds provides startling evidence that any amplified music can lead to hearing damage. Setting the peak levels at 140 dB SPL sound is ridiculous to me. But this is a very muddled area and not everyone will be damaged by that level. If there is ringing in the ears or pain, then there is a high correlation that eventual and irreparable damage will occur, according to Professor Evans. The code is only a guide and as such is unenforceable, even when the final draft arrives. However, the code does require local authorities, the licensors, to monitor pop concerts and liaise with promoters, who will be responsible for carrying out the terms of the license, including noise levels. It's a move that breaks with the traditions of rock and roll, but we could soon see actions for damaged hearing, especially if sound levels are exceeded. The words of the code will hopefully not be falling on deaf ears. That was by Dan Houston.
This week on Sparks, are you boring and unambitious?
spirits in the television, or just strange weather conditions? Chinese teletext? Surely not. Sponsor a species, a new fundraiser for conservation work. A look at the life of little-known Niels Bohr, pioneer of quantum mechanics, the foundation of modern electronics. 20-bit quality from 16, a report from the Audio Engineering Society. Valves to the rescue? How I long for the old airwaves. Do Radio 4 listeners want FM, or are they long-wave junkies? The results of our recent competition, and of course lots more letters, like one from Franco Amadio from Collegino in Italy. He's listening on 6205 with an 11-metre long aerial and an ICOM R71 receiver. He's in Turin. He's 35 years old, and he's a medical doctor. He writes he's got two children, and that our signal was fantastic. Thank you for that letter, Franco Amadio, in northwest Italy.
Microwave radiation hurts the eyes, in Electronics Weekly. Microwave radiation, such as that produced by cellular telephones, can produce cataracts on the lens of the eye, according to a new report published by the National Radiological Protection Board. The NRPB report, which covers radio frequency and microwave radiation, is the third part of a study called The Biological Effects of Exposure to Non-Ionizing Electromagnetic Fields and Radiation. It highlights the problems caused if microwaves are allowed to heat parts of the body. The eye is particularly susceptible because it has no blood supply to cool it down. By the time the lens has been affected, the temperature of the surrounding face would be over 40 degrees centigrade, which most people would notice and find uncomfortable. To cause such an effect, the phone would have to be used for 2 hours. The report also points out that people whose blood flow is reduced will suffer more because their bodies will be unable to take the heat away. For this reason, it suggests that people taking tranquilizers should avoid exposure to microwave radiation. The NRPB study was performed without trying to make suggestions for restrictions to avoid harmful contamination. A government advisory group will meet later this year to recommend changes in the law. And another short piece on a different subject about electronic tags for as little as $1. Electronic tags can be made for as little as $1 using a new chip bonding technique. ISD, the company which has pioneered the method, believes that the new tags will be cheap enough for use as baggage labels by the world's airlines. ISD's tags are part of a system which reads the chip's identities using a 27 MHz international band allocated for industrial, scientific and medical applications. This means that the frequencies are free from interference everywhere in the world. The new chips can be programmed on site with up to 10 digits, and a number of tags can be read simultaneously. ISD also believes that its chip can be packaged in an inert bolus, which can survive and be detected in a cow's stomach, making it suitable for tracing cattle. More conventional cow tags can break and result in glass ending up in human food. Those from Electronics Weekly.
Hey!
In international broadcasting, Philips cracks the code for Chinese teletext. They've overcome the problem of providing a Chinese teletext service compatible with World System Teletext, the European teletext standard. A single chipset can now generate the large number of ideograms in the Chinese language, over 20,000, which previously hindered the development of such a system. Teletext characters are normally coded and stored in a read-only memory, a ROM, but this method is too expensive for use for ideographic languages, as digital code for each ideogram is 6 times the size of a single Latin character. The low-cost solution designed at Philips consists of 3,000 frequently used ideograms stored in ROM, plus a fax-type process for creating occasionally used ideograms from a series of dots stored in random access memory. Western characters are also stored in ROM for mixing languages. Philips technical consultant Dick Bug explained, "The system is not hugely different in its technology to ordinary teletext systems. It's more of an achievement in the compatibility of coding. We worked very closely with the Chinese authorities and came up with a specification that covers the requirements of the Chinese language, and one that is also compatible with the European teletext standard, so that China can exchange pages with Europe should it wish to do so." That was in international broadcasting. Let's hope this new development in communications in China can help spread democracy there somewhat.
Are you boring and unambitious? Then you must be an engineer. So says a survey of final year engineering undergraduates. Carl Schneider reports in Electronics Weekly. Ask most other professionals what they think a typical engineer is like, and they will probably describe a boring, unattractive individual, almost certainly male, with little ambition and poor social skills. This unfortunate stereotype persists, despite a host of initiatives from various engineering bodies during the 1980s to spruce up the image of engineers in Britain. But according to a report published recently, the stereotype is an accurate one. Based on a survey of 2,700 final year engineering undergraduates, the report from Consultant Industry Ventures, IVL, found that those intending to make a career in engineering considered themselves to be less ambitious, less forceful, less socially skillful, and less attractive than those aiming to work outside the industry. According to IVL's managing director, Bruce Hepburn, British engineering firms consistently fail to recruit the brightest and the best engineering students because they fail to market themselves to students and fail to meet the career aspirations of the most able undergraduates. At first glance, the initial findings of the survey are quite positive. Some 36% of engineering undergraduates put down engineering as their ultimate career intention, with a further 36% hoping to move on into engineering management. Unfortunately, the minority of students who plan to leave engineering altogether are the most ambitious, dynamic ones, the high achievers. Only 41% of students intending to stay in engineering consider themselves socially skillful, compared to 64% of those who see their future lying in finance, consultancy, and marketing. Just 18% of budding engineers say they have a forceful personality, while 16% describe themselves as entrepreneurial. In both cases, the figures are around twice as high among those planning to leave engineering. Many of the more ambitious undergraduates who do want to make a career in engineering will end up leaving the industry after a few years, because their employers fail to give them management responsibilities early on. 59% of undergraduates questioned believe that recent graduates are not valued in industry until they have put in a lot of time. Almost 40% believe that engineers do not get to the top in UK companies. Part of the problem lies in the way students get information about engineering firms. Half of those questioned believe company brochures do not tell the truth and that company presentations are boring, and almost 60% said that personnel staff who make presentations to students do not understand engineering. But it is not simply a matter of poor presentation. Ambitious undergraduates who want more than just a technical challenge do not believe engineering will give them the opportunity to use and develop their wider skills. Only 26% of students saw the typical successful engineer as entrepreneurial. 25% saw him or her as having a forceful personality. And just 24% thought he or she had wide interests. When asked what factors they considered most when looking at potential employers, students put training and career development opportunities top of the list, followed by job variety and general atmosphere. Pay only came fifth, and the technical challenge offered only made ninth place. An unpublished section of the survey asked students to give their views on a selection of major UK companies. IVL will not reveal the detailed findings, but there is a sharp divide between oil and chemical companies, which are generally very highly regarded as employers, and manufacturing firms, which have a much poorer image among students. This is reflected in the fact that chemical engineers, targeted by oil and chemical firms, have a much more positive view of engineering careers than their electronics, mechanical and civil counterparts. But does it matter that the more ambitious, broader-based engineering students leave the profession if those that stay are technically competent? Yes, insists Hepburn. We have spoken to major customers of UK manufacturing companies, asking them what factors affect their decisions to award contracts. The ability to provide good service was seen as crucial, and this depends on the quality of the staff. Many companies commented that the quality of engineering manpower in British firms was low. Hepburn acknowledged that many UK manufacturing firms are relatively complacent about the lack of wider social skills among their engineers, but he hopes to help change this.
Here's a letter from Ruggero Massimo, who's a student in Italy, and no doubt very ambitious. He lives in Genoa. Radio Fax is a very interesting station. The programmes are pleasant, and with good and interesting informative content. In particular, I appreciate your very good music. Accept my true congratulations, which come from the bottom of my heart. My favourite Radio Fax. Ruggero Massimo, thanks very much for those comments. He's listening on a Satellite 600 Professional with a 50-metre external long-wire aerial. listening to Sparks on Radio Facts, and on to our competition from a few weeks ago. I asked, what date this year did Radio Facts start transmitting? Well, it may sound easy, but it was a trick question. Of course, the date was January the 1st, 1992. And the person who came nearest is Leif Sandgren in Örebro in Sweden. So here goes. I happened to hear your station on 3910. Happened is the right word, as I didn't know you were there. And the programme seemed so interesting from the very beginning, so instead of going to bed, I stayed up listening. I was very interested to hear about local radio stations such as RSR, Romantic Space Radio. True, or was that a joke? Well, I myself was interested in that, and I've written back to the guy to see what he's up to. So we believe him. That this is what he does, and WLR, continuing with the letter, later about dynamic range problems and the best, your comments about the new Radio Listener's Guide. You have 5 copies to give away, and I will try to get one. I guess you were on a New Year's Eve party, the 31st, and couldn't get up early enough on New Year's Day. You were also watching the concert from Austria on New Year's Day. That's why your broadcast started on the 2nd of January. Right. Well, nearly. Interesting about making the film, he notes, which I presume is commenting about Radio Caroline. The signal strength was very good, with no disturbance at all. So one copy of the Radio Listener's Guide goes to Leif Sandgren in Örebro in Sweden. Well, there were quite a few people who gave the obvious answer, and 4 of them who win are Tom Reed, George Williams in Redruth in Cornwall. He also says, any information about any of the Saishu Matsui communications receivers would be welcome. How well they receive at long distances, shortwave reception capabilities for the cheaper models. Well, we recommend a copy of the excellent and comprehensive receiver shopping list, free from Radio Netherlands, at PO Box 555, 1200 JG, Hilversum, in Holland. And we're preparing a short guide ourselves. I personally use one of the Saisho HF receivers, and I think it's excellent value for the money. The other winners of the competition to receive the 1992 Radio Listener's Guide are Kevin Thorpe and Dave Smith, who's in Llandrindod Wells in Wales. Well, thanks very much to everyone who entered, and I can promise you more competitions in the future.
Grab your things, I'm gonna take you home.
on Sparks next week. As vinyl records are dropped by high street shops, can the format survive? We investigate next week and hold jocks on the telephone. For this week, Apple moves into new areas of consumer electronics. By Larry Black, writing in The Independent from New York. In a move that promises to usher in the next wave of information technology, Apple Computer plans to lend its brand name to a new line of digital-based consumer electronics, ranging from display telephones and multimedia players to personal communicators. By the end of the year, Apple, who pioneered the personal computer, plans to market a wide range of dedicated consumer devices, which exploit applications of multimedia and interactive digital computer technologies. John Sculley, chairman, said at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, "Unlike personal computers, the new devices, which Apple calls personal digital assistants, will focus on specific functions and will be easy to use. The emergence of digital-based computers, video and telephones, which allow users to interact with information sources and customize their services, is creating a new industry," Mr. Sculley added. "Early applications such as CD-ROM, that's compact discs for storing information, and multimedia will allow users to combine high-quality video, sound and animation, leading to a logical follow-on of opportunities," he said. "A variety of industries, entertainment, news organizations, home shopping services, banks, phone companies, will soon offer digital services over digital networks, and Apple hopes to become a provider of technologies and products for some of these markets," he disclosed. Apple plans to start developing what it calls critical mass presence in consumer product markets this summer by introducing a consumer-configured version of its popular low-end Macintosh computer in the US. It will also bring out two CD-ROM-based Macintoshes capable of running its new QuickTime multimedia technology. Last year, Apple dramatically increased its market presence by slashing the price of its Macintosh, helping it sell 60% more of the machines. Mr. Sculley provided few other details of the PDI project, other than to say that Apple Consumer Products would be established as a separate business from personal computers. Analysts praised the new direction, noting that the market for personal computers was becoming saturated and vulnerable both to clones and to cannibalization. But they point out that Apple's venture into CD-ROM and other digital applications will bring it into competition with Japanese consumer electronics giants such as Sony, Matsushita, and Toshiba. Last year, Apple and Sony combined to produce a laptop version of its Macintosh, and Mr. Sculley hinted that the company is in talks with potential consumer electronics partners. Apple, in effect, will be the software producer for the new PDAs, while Sony will probably make the actual Apple-branded hardware. That report from The Independent.